The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is written with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will continue with the article In Search of Siddhartha by Jeffrey Bartholet. The legendary birthplace of the Buddha in Nepal beckons worshippers from around the world and archaeologists hoping to uncover new evidence about the revered spiritual leader. At Lumbini, Buddha's birthplace, at its 1,000 Buddha temple, a massive four-story Tibetan structure with 30 to 40-foot ceilings in the main hall, Buddha's narrative is depicted over 16 giant tapestries, or thangkas. He was very good at everything, one young monk told me as we viewed scenes from Siddhartha's youth. In studies and sports, he was only number one. In one panel, Siddhartha is shown on the evening he departs home to become an ascetic. He's in a colorful, multi-story palace that vaguely resembles the grand monastery in which we're standing. But if archaeology and history tell us anything definite, it's that Siddhartha would have grown up in simpler surroundings. Siddhartha's father was not a king, scholars say, but the chosen or elected leader of a tribal republic. There were no homes of stone or cement or even brick in this region when Siddhartha was alive. He would have lived in a house made of wood or bamboo sticks, dried mud or wattle, with a thatched roof. His floors would likely have been plastered in cow dung. The monks seemed okay with that, noting that Siddhartha's home would have still been a palace compared with what the way the others lived. One devotee compared it to a modern luxury eco-lodge made of natural materials and adorned with flowers. What some monks had a harder time accepting was that scientific denial of miracles. We respect science, but whatever science says is not necessarily 100% correct, said Chöki Nyama Rinpoche, the founder and abbot of the 1,000 Buddha Temple. He was seated cross-legged on a throne-like couch in a reception room, where visitors came and bowed to him. In many religions, they imagine miracles, he told me. The inclusion of these stories, the abbot elaborated, is beneficial for those who believe in them. Such beliefs can instill faith in the practices and thereby lead to what he calls the best miracles of all, fewer negative emotions and the ability to be more kind. For his part, the abbot believes in a world beyond what is scientifically proven. He told me he's had different visions and he has seen different forms of beings. When he saw one such being in Prague once, his host told him the city had ghosts. Scientists have made vital breakthroughs that have improved human lives, he acknowledged. But they've also made atom bombs and are building artificial intelligence that they perhaps cannot control. And they don't know anything about the mind, he says. Buddhists who achieve deep meditative states, he suggested, know more, and their faith should not be disturbed. Other monks and nuns seem more sanguine. Ani Choying Drolma, who is known as the Singing Nun for vocal performances she gives around the world, told me she has a hard time believing that Siddhartha was born from under Maya Devi's armpit. There's a rib cage there, after all, she said. I probed further, asking about the ostentatious ways the Buddha is presented in Lumbini. In some texts, the Buddha warned his disciples against overly relying on his presence. One who sees me in body or hears me in voice will walk the wrong path, he counsels his followers in the Diamond Sutra. An oft-quoted 9th-century Chinese aphorism put it more severely, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, meaning that no one should cling to a teacher or rely on a savior. Yet the main hall of the Tibetan monastery was decorated with hundreds of golden Buddha statues. Drolma acknowledged the apparent contradiction, but she said the different skillful meanings are required for spreading the Buddha's teachings. Not everyone has the capacity to understand the essence of the teaching immediately. It has to come in stages. We try to create symbolic things that help people get the essence more easily. The Buddha's rejection of materialism is for people who are highly intellectual, she added. Many other people need a symbolic support system. For practitioners at a more advanced stage, however, the journey toward enlightenment requires a questioning mind, Drolma says. The Buddha said, don't believe anything just because I'm saying it. Only believe something once you've done the research yourself. He never says, I will liberate you. He only says, I will show you the path. Archaeologists say the current excavation sites encompass a small portion of what is buried around Lumbini. Magnetometry reveals large underground formations throughout the area, many under private land. As UNESCO's Croft puts it, you kick the dirt there and there's something under it. It's very, very rich from an archaeological perspective. One site that is certain not to be excavated by archaeologists anytime soon is a buried stupa at Ramagrama, about 30 miles from Lumbini, which is reputed to hold sacred relics of the Buddha himself, perhaps bits of his bone, teeth, or ashes. On a recent visit, the stupa, a large grassy mound topped by a centuries-old tree, was strewn with magnolia flowers and adorned with white Tibetan scarves called katas. Two young women were practicing their dance moves nearby while a few peasant women herded goats. Ramagrama was once one of eight such stupas said to contain bodily remains of the Buddha. But according to legend, Ashoka had the other seven open so he could remove and disperse the relics to thousands of other stupas across his realm. This particular stupa, as reported by the Chinese pilgrim Faxian in the 5th century AD, was protected by a serpent king or dragon. Geophysical mapping has been done in a wide area around Ramagrama, showing vast complexes of monasteries and other Buddhist structures long buried. Religious considerations preclude any exploration of the Ramagrama stupa itself. According to tradition, even Ashoka the Great did not dare to open the sacred shrine, Achaira points out. Digging into it now would be considered a violation of the site's sanctity. Cunningham, mindful of Buddhist sensitivities, says he's fine with leaving the stupa undisturbed. There are some questions that cannot and probably should not be answered by science, he says. There must be some mystery that remains. Next, we'll move on to an article titled, It's Always High Noon in Tombstone, by Richard Grant. Saddle up for a visit to the most notorious town in the West, where a certain infamous shadow happens day after day. Past and present have an unusual relationship in Tombstone, Arizona. Men dressed as 1880s gunfighters are forever clomping up and down wooden sidewalks with jingling spurs and holstered revolvers on their belts. Women glide past, a mix of 19th century bordello madams, shopkeepers, and wives of wealthy burghers. Some of these costume wearers are reenactors who perform in the daily gunfight shows for tourists. But the majority are locals who are so enamored of Tombstone's history that they habitually dress in Old West clothing. We've got about 35 reenactors in the show, at least 100 regular citizens who get dressed up regularly, and more who'll do it for events and special occasions, says the mayor, Dustin Dusty Esculpe, an affable man in his 70s who owns several businesses in this remote town of 1,368 people in southeastern Arizona. He doesn't do period dress himself, preferring contemporary Western ranch wear, but he describes the Vincent's costume play as part of the town's appeal. On big holiday weekends, many of the visiting tourists get dressed up too. It's not unusual to see 150 Wyatt Earp impersonators strutting about in long black frock coats or drinking in Wild West-themed saloons like Big Nose Kate's, where the female staff members wear 19th century bordello outfits, and where the 1993 Tombstone movie plays over and over on the big screen. In the hit Western, Kurt Russell stars as Earp, the legendary frontiersman, and the movie climaxes with the October 1881 gunfight at the OK Corral, the most famous gunfight in America's history and the foundation of modern Tombstone's identity. Tim Fatig, a local tour guide and author of a 956-page biography of Wyatt Earp, stands outside the two-story Victorian courthouse on Toughnut Street, dressed in a brocaded vest and bowler hat. Of the 500,000 visitors who arrive each year, nearly all of them come because of that gunfight, he says. It was really brought home to me when I met two Buddhist monks from Vietnam. They were wearing robes, they only had a few words of English, and two of them were Wyatt Earp. Mara Sculpe recognizes the central irony in Tombstone's identity. The town became world famous for a gunfight that lasted all of 30 seconds and did not even take place at the OK Corral. It was actually in an empty lot behind the corral. Moreover, townspeople at the time regarded the episode as an embarrassment. were famous for gunfights now, but back then it was the opposite, says Esculpe, whose family has been in Tombstone for four generations. We were renowned for sophistication. We had opera houses and theaters and fresh seafood freighted in from California. The Earp story, by contrast, smacked of frontier thuggery. Yet Tombstone has learned that tourists are most attracted to the gunplay and lawlessness in its past, as portrayed and mythologized by nearly a dozen Hollywood films. The real history of the town, in which gunfighters played a very minor role, is harder to market and commodify, but it's an extraordinary tale. Tombstone was one of the richest mining districts Arizona had ever seen, producing a prodigal fortune in silver and becoming one of the last great boom towns in the American West. In 1877, a tall, lanky, Pennsylvania-born prospector named Ed Scheifelin made his way from California to the Arizona Territory. James McClintock, who published a 1916 history of the region, described Scheifelin as the queerest specimen of humanity ever seen in these parts. His clothing was worn and covered with patches of deer skins, corduroy, and flannel, and his old slouch hat, too, was so pieced with rabbit skin that very little of the original felt remained. His black hair hung down below his shoulders, and his full beard, a tangle of knots, was almost as long, and he appeared to be a fur-bearing animal. Scheifelin was 29 years old and down on his luck. When he declared his intention to look for gold and silver east of the San Pedro River, where the Chiricahua Apaches were still hostile in the language of the day, U.S. soldiers told him that all he would find was his own tombstone. Instead, he made a bonanza silver strike, and in a defiant gesture, he named his first mine Tombstone. A town of the same name was founded a few miles away in 1879, in a location previously known as Goose Flats, surrounded by scrubby, thorny, rocky hills. Despite the lack of a convenient water supply and the threat from neighboring Apaches, it experienced a rapid increase in population and prosperity, all fueled by the silver and gold deposits in the surrounding area. Miners, prospectors, businessmen, professionals, and financiers from California all flocked to the morbidly named city, along with cowboys, gamblers, swindlers, entertainers, and prostitutes. At its height, Tombstone was highly cosmopolitan, drawing fortune seekers from all over the world. Canadians numbered in the hundreds, as did Germans, Austrians, Mexicans, English, Irish, and Chinese. According to an 1880 survey, Tombstone's population also included people from Japan, Sweden, Switzerland, France, Spain, and South America. The town had been built in a hurry, without much concern for hygiene, and it was so infested with rats that it was hard to sleep. Tombstone chronicler George Parsons wrote in his journal, "The rats ran about us all night making great racket, rolled over on one in the night and killed him, mashed him deader than a doornail. Cats were in high demand because of the rat problem and constantly being stolen. Parsons himself was fortunate to spot two cats on the way home from church one night, and he tried to capture them. I was successful and hurried mine home, anxious to get there before I was clawed or bitten to death. Peace tonight amongst the rats." By the mid-1880s, the population topped 10,000. In addition to 110 saloons, 14 gambling halls, and innumerable brothels, the town had schools, churches, telephones, ice cream parlors, a bowling alley, a baseball field, an opera house, and a high-toned French restaurant serving imported wines. Popular drink in Tombstone, belying its straight whiskey reputation, was the gin fizz, a fashionable cocktail with gin, lemon juice, sugar, and soda water. While the town prided itself as the most urbane, sophisticated place between St. Louis and San Francisco, drunkenness, gambling, and debauchery, typical of a frontier mining camp, were the hallmarks of its nightlife. The Birdcage Theater, which opened in 1881 and also served as a saloon and dance hall, is still standing and open for tours. The co-manager with her husband was a remarkable woman called Big Minnie Bignon. According to one popular fantastical legend, she once grabbed a pistol-waving troublemaker, carried him out the door, and hurled him halfway across the street. Prostitution was legal and regulated, and its practitioners were known as good time girls, ladies of the evening, and ceiling experts. One described herself as horizontally employed. Life expectancy was short for these women because of venereal disease, the habitual presence of alcohol and drugs, and impoverished living conditions. Wyatt Earp, a hard-drinking gambler, bordello enthusiast, and lawman who arrived in Tombstone with his brothers in 1879, signed the prostitution license for the Bird Cages Josephine Sarah Sadie Marcus, who would soon become his partner. Doc Holliday, Earp's close friend and partner in the OK Corral gunfight, was a former dentist turned gambler and gunfighter. His girlfriend was a prostitute named Mary Catherine Haroni, better known as Big Nose Kate. Yet most of the town's residents didn't frequent the saloons and gambling halls, and according to Fatig, they wouldn't have recognized Wyatt Earp or Doc Holliday if they were dead on the sidewalk. Silver was the real business of Tombstone, and the focus of its energies and attention. At least 50 mines tunneled into the hills. Many of them were engineering marvels with state-of-the-art mills, engines, and hoists. From 1879 to 1886, the Tombstone Mining District produced $30 million in silver, around $1 billion today, making it one of the most important silver mining centers in North America. The rail bonanza period only lasted from 1878 to 1882. Then twin calamities struck. The price of silver slumped, and the mines flooded with groundwater when miners hit the aquifer. Mining companies installed enormous hydraulic pumps, but they malfunctioned and then caught fire. By 1890, the population had shrunk to 1,800. In 1900, fewer than 700 people remained. It could have easily become a ghost town, but in 1927, a writer named Walter Noble Burns created a sensation with his historical novel Tombstone, an Iliad of the Southwest, in which he transformed the disreputable and largely forgotten gunfight between the Earp brothers and the Cochise County Cowboys into a high-stakes morality play, where essentially as pure high-stakes morality play between good and evil, the Earps and Burns' telling, were essentially as pure as the Knights of the Round Table. Burns and other writers inspired by him put Tombstone back in the national consciousness and inspired popular movies like My Darling Clementine and Gunfight at the OK Corral, and TV shows such as The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, which aired from 1955 to 1961. When visitors started coming in earnest in the late 1950s, the residents understood that tourism could save their beleaguered town. The first gunfight reenactments had taken place in 1929 and had attracted more than 6,000 visitors, but it wasn't until the 1960s that Tombstone became established as a tourism destination. The historic district as it stands today came together in the 1980s. Six eye-catching blocks of restored 1880s storefronts and a handful of original historic buildings. For the first time, costumed actors reenacted gunfight shows daily. Dusty Escapul says his grandfather, who had a mining and ranching interest, hated the Old West tourism. He was mad because it ignored the respectable, hard-working people who built Tombstone, instead putting all the emphasis on decadence and violence. One of the main conflicts in Tombstone these days is among the reenactors themselves. There are currently four gunfight shows, and each has its own costume promoter soliciting customers. In 2017, following an overwhelming number of complaints from visitors and storekeepers about vulgar language and intimidation tactics, the city had to once again enforce an ordinance to keep the hawkers in separate areas. They were aggressively trying to poach each other's customers, often insulting each other's outfits as inauthentic. They were constantly fighting, says an exasperated Mayor Escapule, cursing in public, shoving each other, getting into fistfights, grown men. Tombstone has a long-standing tradition of feuding and contentiousness, reaching back to the frontier days, and Escapule's grandfather and great-grandfather, both prominent local citizens, had a theory to explain it. They said an Apache shaman put a curse on this ridge so that no two white men will ever get along here, the mayor says. I think the curse is working. Besides the conflict among gunfight shows, Escapule says storekeepers often quarrel, yelling and filing lawsuits against each other while citizens get into endless land disputes that keep the area's lawyers and surveyors busy. Tourism, the mainstay of the local economy, has recently opened up an unexpected new sector. 5 different ghost tours are now available to visitors, and investigators like Brian Harris of Goose Flats Paranormal Normal consider the old Silver Town to be one of the most haunted places in the nation. Our readings are off the charts, he says. Tamara Ray, a California singer-songwriter who moved to Tombstone not long ago and started wearing vintage dresses, reports she was drawn to the town by paranormal forces. I can feel the spirits of those who lived here, she says. I would visit and leave, and they kept calling me back. Another recent transplant is Evan Boatman, age 13, standing with his mother Rebecca on Allen Street. They moved to Tombstone a year ago from a nearby Huaca City. She's on costume, but Evan is decked out in a Reno hat, just like Val Kilmer's in the movie, and fringe suede and leather coat with a replica Colt 45 in his gun belt. I love the history, the reenacting, the dressing up, he says. His passion for history and pageantry has already earned him roles in the gunfight shows. First as silent characters, a bartender, a gunshot victim, and then as Billy the Kid in the Oriental Saloon. He's the future, says his mother, as a horse-drawn stagecoach rumbles past. I know one other kid who does this, Evan says to me, with seriousness beyond his years. Most don't care, but it's important to us. We're keeping the Old West alive. Next, we'll move on to an article from The Past is Prologue, titled A Hollywood Ending by John Seemley, A Titanic Achievement in Film and How It Was Almost Forgotten. When Citizen Kane premiered on May 1st, 1941, it wasn't at some historic Hollywood theater, or even at one of New York's fancy movie houses. Instead, the film destined to become the most admired of all time opened more modestly at a former vaudeville hall on Broadway. All glitzier plans had been scuttled by newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst, who believed correctly that the film was a thinly veiled indictment of him. Hearst banned his many newspapers from even mentioning Orson Welles' film making debut, and in many accounts, the magnate had offered a handsome bounty worth more than the film's budget to purchase the negative simply for the pleasure of destroying it. Welles later said a Hearst minion had tried unsuccessfully to frame Welles by sending a 14-year-old girl to his hotel room. It was a full-on campaign to derail the career of the 25-year-old filmmaker before it had begun. Thanks to Hearst's boycott, Citizen Kane was a box office flop, losing the studio RKO at least $150,000, a bit more than $3 million today, even though many early reviewers were gobsmacked. The critic Bosley Crowther, writing in the New York Times, praised the outsized ambitions of writer, director, producer, star Welles, celebrating the young auteur for his brash style, which showed more verve and inspired ingenuity than any of the elder craftsmen have exhibited in years. Equal parts bootstrap fable, think Horatio Alger, and tragedy, think Dr. Faustus. The movie tells the life story of Charles Foster Kane, who rises from a modest Colorado boarding house to the highest echelons of American power as a cocksure media magnate whose meaty fingers could tip the scale of world power, and whose cryptic last word before dying, Rosebud, provides the mystery that drives the film. Yet Welles' startlingly new approach to visual storytelling elevated the rags-to-riches template into high tragedy, an uncomfortable satire. Bucking convention at every turn, Welles skipped around chronology freely, using inventive dissolves and edits to move the viewer back and forth in time. The small touches were groundbreaking. One famous shot in the first minutes of the film, showing reflections in a smashed snow globe, anticipates the film's grand themes of ambition and legacy, and the cracked mirror of memory. Welles attributed these innovations to his own ignorance as a first-time filmmaker entering Hollywood from a career in theater and radio. It's only when you know something about a profession, he told an interviewer, that you're timid or careful. After its unhappy opening in the United States, the film receded until a detailed 1947 essay by the French critic André Bazin, who went on to co-found the iconic French film magazine Cahiers du Cinéma, hailed Citizen Kane as a revolution in film language. French critics and filmmakers championed the film, and Americans gave it another chance. It was released for a second time in the States in 1956 to a broader and more appreciative audience. By 1962, a survey of around 70 esteemed movie critics hailed it as the greatest movie ever made. It is also one of the most influential. In particular, Welles' endless capacity for experimentation, combined with his bullheaded persona, was central inspiration for the new Hollywood directors of the 1970s. The one key element we learned from Welles was the power of ambition, the director Martin Scorsese once said. He is responsible for inspiring more people to be film directors than anyone else in the history of cinema. In a tragic turn, Hearst's hatred managed to do lasting damage to Welles's professionally. The brilliant filmmaker and star found himself having to battle with studios for artistic control, often struggling to fund projects for the rest of his life, and never once made a movie that turned a profit in his lifetime. Welles once joked of his career, "Began at the top and have been working my way down ever since." The long shadow of Hearst's curse only deepened the sense of mystique around Welles' most famous and in some ways most enigmatic movie. One could argue that Welles has triumphed against Hearst in the Battle of Legacies. So the Hearst estate seemed to omit in 2015 when it finally screened Citizen Kane at the magnate's famously garish castle in San Simeon, California. Regardless, the film's scandalous backstory remains an essential component of its all-American greatness. In her 1971 book-length New Yorker essay about the film's production, critic Pauline Kael contended that Hearst ultimately became the victim of his own style of journalism. That is to say, Welles had matched Hearst in his capacity for sensationalism, crafting a brilliant feature film that doubled as its own sort of yellow journalism. In this way, Citizen Kane was not only a high watermark for the American cinema circa 1941, it also anticipated reality television, the celebrity flogging of TMZ, plus other arguably more execrable trends in American entertainment and public life. It is a towering artistic achievement shot through the inky grease of tabloid squeeze. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.